Chapter 36. Marion Morgan arrived from San Francisco with only an hour to spare before Preston Whiteway's banquet for Osgood Hennessy. Lillian Hennessy welcomed her aboard the special and took her to her stateroom in Car 4. She offered to stay to help Marion with her gown, but it was soon apparent to Isaac Bell's fiancée that the beautiful young heiress's main purpose was to ask questions about Archie Abbott. Isaac Bell had already ridden down to the town to inspect the guardhouses protecting the piers of the Cascade Canyon Bridge. He spoke sternly to the guard captain, reminding him for the third time that sentries should change position at irregular intervals so that an attacker could never predict what he was going to run up against. Satisfied for the moment, he hurried to the Cascade Lodge. It was a vast log and timber building decorated with stuffed game, Navajo rugs, rustic furniture that was more comfortable than it looked, and gas lamps with Lewis Comfort Tiffany shades. A band was warming up with "There'll Be a Hot Time in the Old Town Tonight" as he removed the linen duster he had worn over a midnight blue single-breasted tuxedo. Moments later, Osgood Hennessy arrived with Mrs. Comden, Lillian, Franklin Mowry, and Marion. Isaac thought Marion looked stunning in her low-cut red gown. If he had never seen her before in his life, he would have walked right up to her and asked her to marry him. Her green eyes sparkled. She had her blonde hair swept high on her head and her décolletage artfully screened by the ruby necklace he had given her for her birthday. She had removed the bandage that had covered the cut on her cheek from the flying glass. A touch of rouge made it invisible to any eye but his. "Welcome to Cascade Canyon, Miss Morgan," he smiled, greeting her formally since there were too many people around to sweep her into his arms. "I have never seen you more beautiful." "I am so happy to see you," she said, smiling back. Preston Whiteway, trailed closely by waiters bearing champagne and looking flushed like he'd had a few already, bustled up to greet them. "Hello, Marion." He smoothed his blonde waves. "You look great." "Oh, hello there, Belle. How's that locomobile running?" "Like a top." "If you ever want to sell..." "I don't." "Well, enjoy your dinner. Marion, I've seated you between me and Senator Kincaid. We'll have a lot of business to talk about." Osgood Hennessy muttered, "I'll deal with this," went directly to the head table and coolly switched all the place cards. "Father," Lillian protested, "it is uncouth to change place cards."
"If they want to honor me, they can start by seating me between the two best-looking women in the room who aren't my daughter."
"I've put you by Kincaid, Lillian. It's dark work, but someone has to do it. Belle, I moved you between Whiteway and Miss Morgan so he'll stop staring down her dress. Okay, let's eat." No sooner had Philip Dow set foot in the enormous Cascade Canyon yards than a railway cop stopped him.
"Where are you going, mister?"
Dow turned cold eyes on the cinder dick and flashed the sterling silver star. The cinder dick practically fell over himself, backing away.
"Sorry, Captain. I forgot I'd seen you before."
"Better safe than sorry," said Dow, doubly glad to have the badge. Any cop who'd seen him before had a sharp memory for wanted posters.
"Anything I can do to help, Captain?"
"Yeah. Keep it under your hat till morning."
"What's your name, officer?"
"McKinney, sir. Darren McKinney."
"You'll be on the right side of my report, McKinney. I barely put my foot on the property before you spotted me. Good work."
"Thank you, Captain.
Continue your rounds."
"Yes, sir."
Sauntering briskly, relying on his suit and derby to look like an official who belonged among the tank engines shuttling strings of gondolas, Dow crossed track after track. At the head end, Osgood Hennessy's special glowed gold and red just beyond the harsh glare of the bridge lights. The president of the railroad special was parked on a raised siding with a view of the entire yards. Belle danced with Marion between courses.
When are you going to let me teach you that slow Boston waltz?
Not when they're playing There'll Be a Hot Time in the Old Town Tonight. As Preston Whiteway wandered over to cut in, a sharp glance from the Van Dorn detective changed his mind, and he returned to the floor with Mrs. Comden. Dessert was baked Alaska, a cake and ice cream concoction wrapped in meringue. Guests who had never been east of the Mississippi swore it was the equal of any served in New York City's famous Delmonico's restaurant. New York City reminded Lillian Hennessy of Archie Abbott.
"That's quite a smile you're wearing," Charles Kincaid said, interrupting her thoughts.
"I was anticipating your speech," she snapped.
Belle overheard and gave her a private grin.
Lillian noticed that Isaac had been unusually quiet and serious, despite the company of his beautiful fiancée. Nearly as quiet as the anxious-looking Franklin Mowry. Something was really worrying him. She reached past Kincaid to give the poor old man a pat on his hand. He nodded distractedly. Then Preston Whiteway tapped a spoon on a glass, and the double row of plump red faces rimming the long table turned in anticipation.
"Gentlemen and ladies," the newspaper publisher bowed to Emma Comden, Lillian Hennessy, and Marion Morgan, the only women in the lodge, "I am honored you could join me in saluting the great builders of the Southern Pacific Railroad. As they forge ever onward toward their final goal, let them know that our prayers go with them, and let us hope that our fervent admiration will spur them on. Builders make America great, and we are honored to be in the presence of the boldest builders in the West." Shouts of "Hear, hear!" echoed to the rafters. The Californians rose as one, clapping loudly. Osgood Hennessy nodded his thanks. "Just as we applaud these men who build with their hands and their hearts, so do we entreat another man in this splendid banquet hall to build the future of our great nation with his leadership and wisdom. I refer, of course, to our good friend Senator Charles Kincaid, whom I believe just might make an announcement that will gladden the heart of every man and woman in this room. Senator Kincaid."
Kincaid rose, smiling, acknowledging applause. He hooked his thumbs to his lapels as the clapping died down. He gazed at the admiring faces. He turned and smiled at Lillian Hennessy. He looked Osgood Hennessy in the face. Then he turned his attention to the elk and grizzly bear heads jutting from the log walls.
"I have come here at the invitation of the most accomplished businessmen in California and Oregon, men who have worked long and hard to develop this great land. Indeed, this rustic setting reminds us that our manifest destiny in the American West is to tame nature for the prosperity of the entire United States. Timber, mining, crops, and cattle, all served by the great railroads. Now these gentlemen have asked me to lead them toward new accomplishments to benefit our great nation and protect her from her enemies. They have been very persuasive." He looked out over the tables. Belle noticed that he possessed the politician's gift for seeming to look at each and every person. Suddenly, Kincaid turned his lapel inside out, revealing the red and white "Kincaid for President" button he had shown Belle. "I am persuaded," he said, his handsome face wreathed in smiles. "You've talked me into it. I will serve my country as you gentlemen see fit."
"President?" Osgood Hennessy asked Belle as the room erupted in applause and the band played loudly.
"Sounds that way, sir."
"Of the United States?"
Preston Whiteway called out. "That's right, Mr. Hennessy. We gentlemen of California pledge our considerable support to Senator Charles Kincaid, the hero engineer."
"Well, I'll be damned."
"Surprised me, too," shouted a wealthy Redwoods lumberman from Marin County. "He fought us tooth and nail. Practically had to hogtie him before he agreed."
Preston Whiteway acknowledged the laughter, then said, "I believe that Senator Kincaid has a few more words on the subject."
"Just a few," said Kincaid.
I'll be glad to go down in history as the president who gave the shortest speeches. He acknowledged their laughter, then grew sober. As you say, I was honored but hesitant when you first broached the possibility. But the horrific events 2 weeks ago in New Jersey and New York City persuaded me that every public servant must rise to defend the American people from the yellow peril. That dastardly explosion was detonated by a Chinaman. The streets of the city were littered with broken windows. As I went to the aid of the stricken, I will never forget the sounds of the ambulance tires crunching the glass. A sound I will never forget. Isaac Bell listened closely as Kincaid went on in that vein. Did Kincaid believe what he was saying? Or was his warning about the yellow peril the kind of political claptrap his supporters expected? Bell glanced at Marion. A mischievous light was igniting her eyes. She felt his gaze on her and looked down, biting her lip. Lillian leaned behind her father to whisper to her, and Bell saw both women cover their mouths to stifle laughs. He was happy, but not surprised that they had taken a liking to each other. The yellow peril we face, the tidal waves of immigrating Chinamen taking American jobs, frightening American women, was suddenly driven home that terrible night in New York City. That dastardly Chinaman exploded tons of dynamite in a busy rail yard near a crowded city for his own unfathomable reasons that no white man could ever begin to understand. In the shadow of a string of freight cars, Philip Dow watched the lighted windows of the railroad president's special. Senator Kincaid had given him the dining schedule for the employees who lived on the train. He waited until the diner crew had served the guests. Then, while they were eating their own suppers with the porters and the white train crew ate in the baggage car, he climbed aboard the front end of Car 3. He checked the layout in Car 3 and Car 4 and traced escape routes through the train and off each. Car 4's porter station was a small closet with a curtain for a door. It was crammed with clean towels and napkins, cold and hangover cures, a shoeshine kit, and a spirit stove to heat water. Dow unscrewed a light bulb to cast shadow on the short length of corridor along which he would dart to Marion Morgan's stateroom 4. Then he rehearsed. He practiced watching the corridor through the porter's curtain, tracing the route Isaac Bell would take from the front of the car toward the rear. Then he practiced stepping silently into the corridor and swinging his sap. Restricted by the confines of the narrow space, he swept it underhanded. The momentum of running the 3 steps, combined with the long reach that started well behind, would accelerate the heavy pouch of lead shot with deadly force into Isaac Bell's temple. Isaac Bell pressed fingers to his temple. "Headache?" Marion murmured. "Just hoping this short speech will be over soon," he whispered back. "Anarchy!" shouted Charles Kincaid, building steam. "Emperor worship! Who knows how the Chinaman thinks? Hatred of the white man, or deranged by smoking opium, his favorite vice." His supporters leaped up, applauding. Preston Whiteway, red-nosed on good wine, bellowed in Osgood Hennessy's ear, "Didn't the senator nail the yellow peril threat square on the head? We built the Transcontinental Railroad with John Chinaman," Hennessy retorted. "That makes him good enough for me." Franklin Mowry stood up from the table and glanced at Whiteway, muttering, "Next time your train glides through the Donner Summit, cast your eye on their stonework." Whiteway, deaf to dissent, grinned at Marion. "I'll wager that old Isaac here applauds Senator Kincaid's understanding of the threat, since he's the hotshot detective who stopped that opium-maddened Chinaman in his tracks." Bell thought that Whiteway's grins at Marion were getting dangerously close to leers. Dangerous for Whiteway, that is. "The motivation appears to have been money," Bell replied sternly. Dodging Marion's kick under the table, he added,
We have no evidence that the man who paid him smoked anything stronger than tobacco.
Mowry gathered up his walking stick and limped toward the porch. Bell hurried to hold the door for him, as his young assistant had not been invited to the banquet. Mowry tottered across the covered porch and leaned on the railing that overlooked the river. Bell watched curiously. The engineer had been acting strangely all day. Now he was staring at the bridge piers, which were lighted by the electric arc lamps. The old man seemed mesmerized. Bell joined him at the railing.
Quite a sight from down here.
What? Yes, of course.
Is something the matter, sir? Are you not feeling well?
Water's rising, said Mowry. It's been raining a lot. In fact, I think it's starting up again now. The rain only makes it worse.
Beg your pardon, sir?
For thousands of years, the river has descended from the mountains at a steep gradient, Mowry answered, as if lecturing from a textbook. At such a gradient, countless tons of debris tumble in the water. Abrasive materials, earth, sand, gravel, rocks. They grind the riverbed deeper and wider. In doing so, they dredge up more debris. Where the river's gradient decreases, she deposits this material. Crossing flats like the one this town's built on, the river spreads out and meanders. Her channels interweave like braid. Then they bunch up here in the gorge, laying down tons and tons of sediment. God alone knows how much lies between here and bedrock.
Suddenly, he looked Bell full in the face. His own features reflected skull-like in the harsh electric light.
The Bible tells us a foolish man builds his house on sand, but it doesn't tell us what to do when we have no choice but to build on sand.
I suppose that's why we need engineers. Bell smiled encouragingly, sensing that the engineer was trying to tell him something that he was afraid to voice. Mowry chuckled, but did not smile.
You hit that nail on the head, son. That's why we trust engineers.
The door opened behind them. We're heading back up to the train, Marion called. Mr. Hennessy is tired. They thanked their hosts and said their goodbyes. Charles Kincaid came with them, giving Franklin Mowry an arm to lean on. Isaac took Marion's hand as they walked through the rain to the foot of the steep freight line. She whispered, I am going to plead weariness from my long journey and slip off to bed.
Not too weary, I hope, for a knock on your door.
If you don't, I'll knock on yours.
They boarded the Snake Line passenger car in which they had arrived. Three engines in front and two in back huffed them slowly up the steep switchbacks to the plateau where Hennessy's special was parked on its siding, windows glowing in welcome. Come on in, gents, Hennessy ordered. Brandy and cigars.
I thought you were tired, said Lillian.
Tired of businessmen blathering, Hennessy shot back. Ladies, there's champagne for you in the diner while the gents have a smoke.
You're not getting rid of me, said Lillian.
Mrs. Comden stayed too, quietly needlepointing in a corner chair. Marion Morgan said good night and headed back to her stateroom. Isaac Bell, waiting a decent interval for propriety's sake, continued to observe Kincaid closely.
Philip Dow looked out the curtain when he heard someone enter the stateroom car from the front vestibule. He glimpsed a beautiful woman walking toward the porter's station. She wore a red gown and a full necklace of red rubies. Such displays of wealth usually raised a visceral anger in the Union man, but he was taken by her happy smile. Women as beautiful as she, with her straw-blonde hair, long, graceful neck, narrow waist, and coral sea-green eyes, always smiled like they were congratulating themselves on their looks. This one was different. She smiled with happiness. He hoped she would not stop at Marion Morgan's door. He dreaded having to kill such a lovely creature. but she did stop and enter stateroom 4. He had never killed a woman. He didn't want to start now, particularly this one, but he was not eager to meet the hangman either. Quickly, he revised his plan of attack. Instead of waiting for her to open the door when Isaac Bell knocked, he would strike the instant that Bell raised his hand to knock. Bell would not be as distracted as he would be a moment later, stepping into her arms. The detective would be more alert to defending himself, but that was the price Dow was willing to pay for not killing her. He shoved his revolver in his belt so he could grab it quickly if Bell managed to dodge the sap. A gunshot would complicate escape, but he would pay that price too, not to kill the woman. Unless she gave him no choice.